Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Dina Temple-Raston, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For months now, the world has watched a Ukraine in crisis. We've seen fires and violence, a president on the run, a fragile new government, a Russian land grab. This week has brought more news of death and destruction in the eastern part of the country. Helicopters have been shot down, people have been killed. Amid all this, there's a referendum scheduled for next week and an election looming at the end of the month. This hour, On Point, with Ukraine on the brink, what's next? You can join us on air or online. What are you seeing happening in Ukraine? Is it teetering, already over the edge? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll go to the mind of Russian President Vladimir Putin and how the world is reacting to, addressing, and trying to salvage Ukraine. But first, to the ground in Ukraine. This week, speaking with the BBC, one pro-Russian fighter in the city of Slavyansk vowed that the militia would continue to fight with Ukrainian law enforcement. Here he is, interpreted by the BBC.
We will fight to the very end, this man says. None of us in the militia planned to leave, and we will not leave. The very name of the town of Slavyansk speaks for itself, Slavs. And Slavs do not surrender.
Joining me now with the latest in Kiev is Sabra Ayres, foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's covered Ukraine throughout this crisis. Sabra Ayres, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
Well, Sabra, you've been there in the Ukraine for a long time. You've been there since the beginning, and it seems to be changing day to day. Can you tell us the latest?
Well, the latest is the situation in the east continues to deteriorate ahead of the so-called referendum that's supposed to take place on Sunday, the May 11th referendum, in which the Donetsk Republic, as they're calling it, is going to ask if people think that it should be a sovereign state. It's very vague. But in the meantime, the sort of a lawlessness that's been going on in the East is really worrisome, and it definitely has gripped the entire country.
When you talk about lawlessness, what do you mean? What are you seeing?
Well, there have been reports and from the sort of video footage you can see, there have been sort of, they've attacked banks. They obviously have taken over government buildings, everything from police stations to city administration buildings to regional administration buildings. But they've also attacked several bank branches. I've heard reports of some jewelry stores being broken into. And the police have basically, in some areas, given up their guns to the so-called separatists. So it's I just was meeting with a friend from Lugansk, which is in the east as well, and she said that she right when they were getting on the train last night, there was some shooting in the street, and she said that she described the situation as just complete. Nobody is in control.
So is this pockets of violence, or is this feeling more like a prelude to war?
I think from talking to people, I have been in the east. I'm currently in Kyiv. So from talking to a group of Ukrainians that are from the east just not a half hour ago, to them it feels like, and from what we see, that it's sort of a this sort of street fighting thing that is happening, that is a prelude to some sort of kind of guerrilla-like war between those separatists, as some people are calling them, and people who are trying to fight against them. And caught in the middle are those sort of average Ukrainians who want stability, want a country that is governed properly, and want some economic prosperity.
There have been some talk about pro-Russian rebels using human shields, sort of hiding out in the neighborhoods. Have you heard about that as well?
Yeah, I have heard reports of that, and I have heard that there are. I think it's a, probably a complicated situation because I think that there are unarmed people in those areas that are believe a lot of the propaganda that's been coming out in the Russian media about the fear of these sort of fascists, as they're being called, and I'm putting quotes around that, Western Ukrainians who are going to try to impose language laws on them and restrict them from their sort of Russian culture. And I think that those guys are on the street and they may be near the separatist rebels and are kind of getting caught up in it. I can't say when I was out there that I saw them, you know, actually putting civilians in front of them. But I think it's a mix of people and the fear that the Ukrainian army that's now operating, working on their anti-terrorism operation, is shooting randomly is something that's gotten people very frightened.
Right. I mean, do you get the sense that these are bands of people moving from neighborhood to neighborhood, or does it seem more organized than that?
It doesn't seem organized at all, which I think makes it the most scary or worrisome, you know, because I've been out there, and then when I just, as I said, met with a group of people from the East, is that there isn't very much leadership happening there. There's not one person that they are listening to. They all have different ideas, different various levels of if they want to be part of Russia, if they want to be part of an autonomous region of Ukraine. And there just seems to be people reacting in a violent way without any sort of direction.
Which brings us back to this referendum you talked about for autonomy for parts of eastern Ukraine. Is that going to go ahead? Can it go ahead?
Well, it's going to go ahead, and as far as we can tell, they're very determined to hold it. The pro-Russia Donetsk People's Republic guys are determined to hold it. Whether or not the average Eastern Ukrainian will vote, my sense is that a lot of them will not, because of fear of there's a lot of fear in the streets now, just going out with guys walking around with Kalashnikovs and that sort of thing. So, but also the thing is that I think a lot of people will feel that it doesn't have any validity. I think it doesn't even matter if they don't vote, because I think that whatever happens, this is going to be, the referendum. Yeah, exactly. And, it sounds cliche, but a woman I just spoke to from Lugansk told me, how could you have a referendum while we have guys standing at the polling stations with Kalashnikovs? And another guy replied, he's from Donetsk, which is the neighboring eastern region. He said, well, they did it in Crimea, didn't they?
Right, exactly. Was anything planned for this Victory Day, May 9th, that's supposed to be a celebration of the Soviet defeat of Nazi Germany? Or are people quelling any sort of celebration?
Well, in Kyiv, they've called off the annual parade. This is obviously a big holiday for this part of the world. Ever since I've been covering this region, the victory of the Soviet Union really does claim, and rightly so, that they played the largest part in the victory in World War II. So this is a big holiday for them. But in Kyiv, they have canceled the annual parade out of fear of any sort of provocations, as they say. This will be a big day in the East, where there's a lot more Soviet nostalgia out there. And there is this people are on edge about what could happen tomorrow and the next day as in preparation to this holiday. So you hear about these self-defense teams, which you've probably been reading about. Here on Maidan, a lot of them have gone and said they're going to protect the city, try to ward off any sort of provocations. There's been some the police units have put up some sort of roadblocks, not heavy roadblocks, but sort of speed traps, not speed traps, but things that you would see in America when people when the police would stop cars randomly. And so not any sort of block posts like you're seeing out in the East.
Right. And in Odessa yesterday, officials launched a new police force, Kyiv 1, to try and help calm the situation there. Do you know very much about that police force? And is that the sort of thing that you were just talking about?
I think I don't know that much about it, except for what I've read and what they've said, what the government said about it. I think it has some potential problems, although Odessa did show, and it does have a lot of sort of pro-unity support. So for those who do want to see a continuation of a united Ukraine and not see the split. But there are definitely voices down there that don't. And this arrival of sort of a Kyiv-based or Kyiv-centric police force could cause more problems.
What should we be looking for next?
I think that this weekend we unfortunately may see more violence, especially around the Victory Day in the east. There are fears that it could happen in the capital. I think that the idea is the destabilization before the presidential elections on the 25th. I think that the presidential elections will go ahead. That's what I gather. Ukrainians believe in voting. They will participate in that vote. They won't, I think, as many participate in the referendum vote. But for that presidential election, Ukrainians will go out for it. I think we are, the next couple of days will be sort of a little bit touch and go in terms of what happens in the east.
Great. Thank you so much for talking with us. That was Sabra Ayers, the foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, based now in Kyiv. I'm Dina Temple-Raston, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Dina Temple-Raston, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Ukraine on the brink, with Russia looming large over the border. Yesterday, speaking with reporters, Secretary of State John Kerry spoke about a referendum for autonomy for parts of the eastern Ukraine, scheduled for Sunday. He condemned it as contrived.
This is really the Crimea playbook all over again, and no civilized nation is going to recognize the results of such a bogus effort.
And today, Russian media announced that Russian President Vladimir Putin says the Sunday referendum on autonomy should be delayed. We'll see. Of course, Russia has played no small role in the crisis in Ukraine, but ask Putin and he'll say his actions are warranted. During a televised call-in Q&A last month, Russian President Vladimir Putin argued that the post-Cold War expansion of NATO is the threat to Russia, and that's what's spurring his actions regarding Ukraine. Here's Putin, interpreted by PBS.
When the infrastructure of the NATO military bloc is approaching our borders, it raises certain questions for us. We have to take some steps in response. If we don't do anything, they will drag Ukraine to NATO and tell us that it's not our business.
Joining me now in Washington with the broad picture is Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, former National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council, and former member of the Office of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State. Her latest book, just out, is called The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Angela Stent, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Dina. Great to be on the show.
Thank you. We just have something that's breaking news, that Putin has urged postponing the Eastern Ukraine referendum. He said the upcoming presidential elections in Ukraine, slated for May 25th, are a move in the right direction, but he repeated that constitutional reforms would have to precede any nationwide vote in Ukraine. What's your reaction?
Well, I think my reaction is that some of the sanctions that have been imposed are maybe working, because these are not positions that President Putin had just a couple of weeks ago. He had said then that the May 25th election shouldn't be held, and he'd said nothing about this referendum. So maybe the Kremlin is stepping back and thinking that maybe it should go slower on what's happening there. And I think probably what they're doing now is, if they're willing to accept that there will be a May 25th election and they are maybe willing to accept its results, and those are two big maybes, then I think their next move will be to try and influence what happens with constitutional reform. Ukraine is a unitary state by its constitution and will remain so, at least what's left of Ukraine. But I think the current government, and I'm sure the future one, will recognize that there has to be some more devolution of powers. For instance, all governors are now nominated in Kiev. I think the idea is that they could be elected locally. There could be some more budgetary authority that's devolved to the local authorities. So there would be ways of changing the constitution, modifying it, so that the different regions of Ukraine feel that they have somewhat more of a say over governing their own affairs.
But we have to get through this referendum on May 11th first.
Well, and if they do hold the referendum, and I was listening very with great interest to your report, and then the minority of people who vote then proclaim that the answer is yes. I'm not sure myself what the question is, but presumably the answer is secession from Ukraine itself. Then the issue will be what happens after that, and does anybody then try and influence them to step down from this, or if they won't, then of course the level of tension will continue at least until the election on May 25th, and it may be very difficult in the eastern parts of Ukraine to hold the election there.
You know, from this distance, the battle appears very nationalistic. Is it? Is there really a chasm between Ukrainians and pro-Russians? I mean, the propaganda makes it sound something like Bosnia or Kosovo. Is it really that bad?
I think some of this is exaggerated. Certainly, historically, there is a difference between the western parts of Ukraine that only became part of the Soviet Union after World War II and the eastern parts of Ukraine, which had been in the Russian orbit and the Soviet orbit for a few hundred years. But if you look at public opinion data from younger people in the east, they, you know, support a unitary Ukrainian state. They want to look to Europe. They want to look to the West. They don't have Soviet nostalgia. So I think there's a generational gap there. I think the further east you go and the older you are, then there maybe is a real chasm between west and east. But I think it's easy to exaggerate this because of all the propaganda that you hear coming from the east.
Well, Angela, you've met with Russia's President Vladimir Putin many times. So what's your sense? What's his end game here?
Well, I think his end game, and he's been quite clear about this in the 10 years that our group's been meeting with him, is that he believes that the former Soviet space should be a sphere of privileged Russian interests, which means they should remain within the Russian orbit and they should not move closer either to NATO or to the European Union. Now, NATO membership really has never been on the cards for Ukraine. There was a discussion in 2008 during the Bush administration. There was an attempt to get Ukraine to give it a membership action plan where it could one day have joined NATO, but Germany, France, and other NATO members were against this, and the current Ukrainian government has said that Ukraine isn't interested in joining NATO. But I think Putin's game plan is to just ensure as much as he can that these structures, the European Union, NATO, don't move any closer to Russia, and that Ukraine remains a weak country and within the Russian orbit. That's the ultimate goal. But I think beyond that, and you heard that in his speech announcing the annexation of Crimea, it's really to question the entire post-1991 Cold War settlement, the borders of these new independent states. He's looking at Transnistria, which is the separatist enclave of Moldova, where there's also a movement, a pro-Russian movement there, and separatist groups have asked to join Russia and maybe in other parts of the former Soviet Union. So I think it's certainly to weaken Ukraine and keep it in the Russian orbit, but I think his goals ultimately move beyond that, really to the rest of the former Soviet space.
Does Putin care more about the Ukraine than the West does, so he's willing to risk more?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Russia's right next door. This is a number one priority for President Putin, is the creation of a Eurasian Union, is, again, the drawing together the post-Soviet states. United States is a long way away. We have a lot of other foreign policy issues with which we are at the moment concerned, Iran, Syria, Afghanistan, and others. So this is an inevitable asymmetry, and so we're at a disadvantage to begin with.
Right. Angela Stent, please hold. I want to bring in another voice. Joining us now is John Kornblum. He's an expert on U.S. Eastern European political and economic relations. He's a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, former U.S. Ambassador to Germany, and now he's a senior counselor at NUR, LLC, an international law firm based in Berlin, Germany. Today, he's joining us from Nashville, Tennessee. John Kornblum, welcome.
Good morning, Dina.
John, could you take us to where the U.S. and the European Union stand today in this latest round of sanctions? And do you think they're starting to bite?
Well, I hope so. I think the fact that this referendum, so-called referendum, has been either called off or postponed is a good sign. But I think the sanctions, let's be clear about sanctions, the sanctions are not in any way going to bring Russia to its knees. The purpose of sanctions of this sort are to demonstrate that we take the issue seriously and that the United States and the European Union will not simply allow Russia to range freely in what it, as Angela put it very well, considers it to be its territory. Sanctions are as much a political tool as they are an economic tool.
So what can the U.S. do?
Well, what the U.S. can do is do what it's been doing, pointing out that there was a post-Cold War settlement, that this post-war settlement, I negotiated very big parts of it in the 90s, early and mid-90s. The settlement is based on the rule of law. The settlement does not tell a country that it has to be like the West, as Putin often seems to suggest. It does, however, commit the countries who signed it, and Russia signed it, to behave according to the principles of international law and to the principles of a modern civil society, which means democracy. Russia very clearly signed all of this. And it is important for Americans to understand this foundation, because in the end, this is also the foundation that we want to be operative in the rest of the world. If we give up now and allow Russia to trample on the rule of law, China, which is a country which is only, shall we say, marginally related to the rule of law, will say, well, see, we can get away with it, or other countries. So what the West needs to do right now is stand on its principles, demand that the rule of law be set forth, and that means a free election in Ukraine, and make sure that we state clearly that we will not accept behavior from Russia which goes clearly against these principles.
Angela, let me turn to you. You said earlier that you thought perhaps President Putin's saying that the Ukrainian presidential poll is a step in the right direction may be an indication that the sanctions are working. Why do you think it's that is doing this? Why do you think they are working? And where do you see an indication, aside from that, that it is?
Well, there is... what we do see is that the sanctions on individuals that have been imposed so far maybe haven't bitten that much, but you already see companies unwilling to invest in Russia because of all the uncertainties about what's happening going forward. You see banks unwilling to participate in loans and credit issues and things like that in Russia because they, too, are concerned about the uncertainty there. The Russian finance minister last week said that Russia may have a negative growth rate this year. So even before all the events in Crimea and Ukraine, the economy wasn't doing that well. So I think people around Putin certainly are beginning to understand that going along, these sanctions will have an impact because they will deter further investment. And the U.S. has signaled that it would impose more unilateral sanctions if the Russians interfere with the May 25th election. And I believe Chancellor Merkel agreed with that. We don't know what the European Union sanctions would be. So I think that's where it is. It's supposed to have a deterrent effect, and maybe it really is having a deterrent effect. Now, no one has been explicit about what they mean by the word interfere with the May 25th election, and we'll have to see what happens with that. But I think this is a signal that someone in the Kremlin understands that there really will be more severe economic consequences if they were not, say, to allow the or to interfere very markedly with the May 25th election.
John Kornblum, on that same sort of note, what kind of let me ask this question. Andrei Kozarev, the former Russian foreign minister, told PBS NewsHour this week that U.S. words have not been followed by deeds, and that, and these are his words, is both confusing and counterproductive. Do you think that's the problem?
Well, which words did he mean? Did he mean these today or 20 years ago? That's an important point.
Right. He wasn't
there
clear.
There is, as we call it in modern American English, an urban legend running around, and you quoted Putin with it also, that the West broke all of the deals with the Russians. It expanded NATO. It tried to lure Western, former Soviet republics into its sphere, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is true if the Russians believe that we agreed that they could have a sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union. But, of course, that's not the case. And the many agreements and documents which were signed after 1992 made that point very clear. It is also not true because most of the countries, in fact, all of them, who went into NATO or the European Union did it because they desperately wanted not to be part of post-Soviet space. And here is the problem. The problem is that the Russians know that the dynamic in Europe is going against them. Their economy is not doing well. Countries who have a chance to move into the Western world want to do it. The Republic of Georgia has stated very clearly and will hopefully sign an association agreement with the EU in June. Moldova has a democratic government which wants to join the European Union. In other words, on the one hand, Putin is maintaining an authoritarian state based on, shall we say, the glory of Russia. On the other hand, all of the countries who have a chance not to be part of the Russian sphere choose it very rapidly and, as we saw in the Maidan demonstrations in Ukraine, with great emotion. So no, it's not that the West didn't live up to its word. I worked with Kosovo for a lot in the 1990s, and he knew exactly what we were doing. It is the fact that since 1990, Russia has moved very slowly into the modern world, both economically and politically, and the people on its borders, many of them former Soviet republics, really want to be part of the West. That galls them, but it is also a domestic political weakness for Putin, and he clearly has now decided that he has the means and maybe also the disinterest of the West to allow him to change this trend. Right. And as I said earlier, it is this which is important to us.
Right. John, are we entering a new Cold War? Is our relationship with Russia going to start looking more like our relationship with China? We'd be friends on matters in which we agree and dust-ups when we don't.
Well, I wouldn't call it a Cold War because the Cold War had a very specific connotation of a major global ideological confrontation. It could be a term that actually President Yeltsin coined in the 1990s. It could be a so-called cold peace. That is, we're not going to be stable, facing each other with major military confrontations. But I think you put it very well. It's going to probably be a situation such as with China. The big difference is that China is a growing important economic partner for the West, and Russia is not.
This is On Point. I'm Dina Temple-Raston in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Ukraine in the spotlight. Joining our conversation today is Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University and author of the new book, The Limits of Partnership. And also with us is John Kornblum, former ambassador to Germany and a senior counselor for NUR LLC, an international law firm based in Germany. Thanks for coming back with us. We've just gotten a bit of a news bulletin here. Vladimir Putin of Russia said that the Russian troops have been pulled back from the Ukraine border, and he urged separatists in eastern Ukraine to postpone their May 11th referendum. Angela, what do you think?
Well, if he's just announced that the troops are being pulled back, I think we have to verify that, because remember, he told Chancellor Merkel he was going to do that a few weeks ago and nothing happened. But if that's true, then indeed, again, it appears that he understands that Russia really has to try and de-escalate some of the tensions, because, of course, you do have a creeping civil war there. And there have been, you know, the West has warned very strongly of more and much tougher sanctions if the situation doesn't improve.
John, what do you think? He apparently said this to the president of Switzerland and the current head of the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. He says, "We've pulled them back. Today, they are not at the Ukrainian border, but in places of regular exercises at training grounds." That's according to the New York Times.
Well, if that's true, that's very good news. It shows, I agree completely with Angela, that he perhaps and the feeling that he had gone too far, that he really didn't want to have a full civil war in Ukraine. For me, the most important thing is this election on the 25th of May, because it will put a accepted and hopefully legitimate foundation under the discussion. Right now, it's nothing more than people's views about what's going on, some of them very educated, some of them not. But this election, even if it's flawed in some ways, I could give you other examples where they have worked. It worked in Bosnia very well, for example. Gives us a base point to work from. And hopefully then the Western countries, and hopefully working closely with Russia, nobody wants a confrontation with Russia, hopefully can work from this base point to establish a stable system in Ukraine, which does in fact take care of everybody's interests.
Okay, I wanted to go to a couple of callers. We have Lilo, who is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Lilo. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Ukraine.
Hi, Dina.
How are you? What's your question?
I just wanted to express just that even when I lived in Ukraine 10 or so, more than 10 years ago, that there was already such a split when you were there. I lived in the west of Ukraine in Lutsk and spent a lot of time in Lviv, and there was already so much of a difference between the East and the West really embracing Western Europe and the U.S. more, and in fact not even speaking Russian in those parts of the country and showing a lot of reverence for Shevchenko and Lesya Ukrainka. And I guess what I just wanted to express is I'm so disappointed because even back then I think you could see that there could be this civil war in the future, and now I feel like it's really becoming much more apparent, and I'm just interested in whether or not the guests feel that might indeed happen, even if this Russian interference over passes.
What do you think, Angela? Do you think that this is a division that has just been waiting to happen?
Well, I think the undercurrents of it, of course, were always there. Again, the industry in the East, we have to remember, particularly the military-industrial complex, is very tied to Russia. Russia's dependent on it for its own military hardware, but the Ukrainians are in the East are for Russian orders. I mean, I think the problem is, given what's happened in the past few months, it's going to be very, very difficult to put Ukraine together back, or what's left of Ukraine, minus Crimea, as a strong functioning state. And I think the most important thing, and John has already alluded to that, for the United States and the Europeans to do after this May 25th election is to give as much economic, political, logistical support to the new government in Kiev to really enable it to reestablish control over the country, which it doesn't have anymore. For 22 years, Ukraine really hasn't been very successful in building strong, modern institutions of state governance, and they really need to pay attention to that to deal with all the corruption that led to the revolution, that led to Yanukovych's fleeing. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult to put it back together again, but it will only work if the U.S. consistently remains involved with Ukraine, which it hasn't over the past 22 years, and the Europeans as well, and really work with the new Ukrainian government going forward to create a viable state.
Right. We have another call I'd like to take. Carl is calling from Stamford, Connecticut. Carl, you're on.
Hi, Dina.
Hi there.
I will just one comment and then a question. My heart is just ripped to pieces about what has been happening in Ukraine. I was a banker to Ukraine from about 1995 to 2007 with a large multilateral institution. We did business with Russians, with Ukrainians, with even ethnic Romanians. It's a very diverse country, and I traveled all over the place. It's so infuriating to see Putin getting away with what he's been doing and our inattention to that country for years. My question really, I guess, is more to John. I'm very curious about what the Germans are thinking and what are they really, I think the key here, the biggest weapon that we have in sanctions is freezing the Russian assets. Don't let them get paid for their oil. if their economy is really as teetering as we believe it is, and Putin has used the nationalist card to, for his own political gain, this is one way to get the eyes turning right back on their own sad state of their economy very quickly. I'd like to hear a comment from your guests.
What do you think, John? Should we be going after oil?
Well, that's a very good question. Also, the question of Germany's role. It would be very hard to go after oil because Russian oil and gas provide at varying levels of a large part of the oil and gas supplies for Europe. Some countries, such as Finland, are 100%. Germany is about 30%. Other countries are maybe 5 or 10%. But to do a total cutoff of oil revenues would lead to a fairly major economic dislocation, if not crisis, in Western Europe. But his question about Germany is important because it goes back a little bit to what Angela just finished saying. There's one person to blame for all of this, and that is Putin. The second level of people to blame are Ukrainian political leaders who have really governed their country, if you can call it that, very poorly. But at the same time, it is true that both the United States and Western Europe, after the Cold War was over, after NATO and EU were enlarged, essentially lost interest in this part of the world and didn't, I think, understand that Russia itself was a complex country that needed an awful lot of management and that Ukraine needed perhaps even more. My own view is that one of Putin's reasons for doing all this is simply hurt feelings. He hasn't been treated like the big power that he thinks he is by the United States. In fact, the United States, both under Putin, under Obama and under George Bush Jr., have essentially ignored Russia. And so I think the underlying answer here is that the United States remains the basic power in the world. If we don't tend the structures, no one will, and we haven't been tending the structures. Our German friends are very nervous about this. There's a long history of back and forth between Germany and Russia, and I think that the Chancellor's visit here last week started us again back on the right track. But the United States really must get engaged, and I'm sorry to say our government hasn't understood this.
Well, Angela, to that point of hurt feelings for President Putin, do you think that we're seeing a new generation of warfare from Russia, that because it doesn't have the big military and the big economy, it's using targeted information, campaigns, propaganda, cyber, quasi-legal justifications to do what it's doing? You know, some people in Washington call this kind of battle lawfare instead of warfare. Do you think that's what's going on?
Well, first of all, some of this is a throwback to the Soviet times, some of the kind of special operations and the kind of thing you saw, well, in Crimea before it was annexed and then in eastern Ukraine. That's an old playbook. It's not a new one. But, of course, you know, one, coming back to your question about is this a new Cold War, as John Kornblum said, we're not global antagonists, but also we're not strategic rivals with Russia because we have a much more powerful military than the Russians do. So they do have to use all of these other means of imposing their will, and they're very good at doing that. They're obviously very good at the cyber part of it. I think after China, they're the second largest cyber problem, if you like, in the world. And it is true that President Putin feels that Russia has been disrespected for the last 22 years. And that, you know, particularly after the 9/11 attacks, when Russia offered its support to the United States in the first phase of the war in Afghanistan, what Putin really wanted was what one of my Russian colleagues has called an equal partnership of unequals. He wanted to be regarded by the treated by the United States as if Russia were an equal, even though it isn't economically or militarily, certainly. And he didn't get that. And part of that respect, what he considers to be respect, would be an acknowledgement, and this is the problem, that Russia has this sphere of privileged interest in the post-Soviet space. And that's part of the reason why he feels disrespected. I don't think the United States has ignored Russia. I think what we have done, though, is that in the past 22 years, Russia has become a second-order priority for the United States, very important in enabling us to achieve what we want to do in other parts of the world, but not a top priority per se, whereas, at least until recently, the U.S. was the top priority for Russia, and I think that's been very difficult for the Russians to accept.
John, I usually cover counterterrorism, and it seems to me that Putin has torn a bit of a page out of the jihadist playbook, basically waging an asymmetric war. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right, except I think Angela put it very well. This is a tactic which goes back to the Bolsheviks in the early 20th century. Russia was always a weak country. The Soviet Union was a very weak country. And it always used all of these asymmetrical tactics to get its ends. If you look at the way Czechoslovakia was turned into a communist country, if you look at the way that Berlin was surrounded, et cetera, it was never done with a military attack. It was always done with these kind of methods. So in a way, it's the other way around. The jihadists have taken their tactics from a Soviet playbook, and they have adapted them very successfully. But I think that what you see here is, as Angela put it, a country which knows that it's very much on the defensive, at the same time believes that it has the advantage of surprise, the advantage of geographic proximity, and believes, and I've seen this myself in many, many different ways, a certain disdain for the West, because he feels, he says this quite openly, we're becoming a corrupt, perverse, whatever you want to call it, society. And he believes that Russia has the purity and the determination to defend its interests. I think this is all nonsense, if I may put it that way. But it has obviously motivated him to a certain extent.
Okay, I want to take another call. Brian is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Brian, go ahead.
Hello, Dina. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
I think we need to sit down with the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin, sit down and create a new friendship in the world. No sitting president has ever been able to do anything in that region. There are a lot of Russians there. However, we can't let them disrespect the sovereign nation that's there. We need to partner with them. In one respect, with some world peace plans that I've implemented to the White House. That involves Russia selling natural gas to Iran, General Electric putting in some water-cooled gas turbines to create electricity, as opposed to Iran having nuclear power. And we need to all sit down, stop the drama, and go forward with what needs to be done. We also need to sit down with them, teach them how capitalism works. We can't get any gas companies in there or companies in there to invest. If they're going to feel threatened about losing their land or whatever they invest in themselves as far as real estate. So we need to sit down with Russia, explain to them a little bit more how democracy works, and quit going backwards, back in time, and start going forward and make solutions instead of rehashing problems. And that's pretty much what we need to do.
What do you think, John? You've been on the discussion end of this. Do you think we need to partner with them more than we are?
Actually, I do. I think that, as both Angela and I have said, that after we had this great rush of idealism in the 1990s, and where there were four or five arrangements were made, which we thought would put a very solid foundation under our relationship with the new Russia, and even at the beginning of the Putin era, when there were quite warm relations with the United States and also with Western Europe, it's not that we became enemies of Russia, but we sort of neglected them. And we extended our democratic perimeter all the way out to the borders of the former, in fact, across the borders of the former Soviet Union. I think that was a very important thing to do. But we didn't continue it with dialogue. And I'll just give one small example. In 2008, Russia had a war with Georgia. It's still not clear who started it, but it ended up with 20% of Georgian territory being taken. Once that war started, the NATO alliance canceled all meetings of the NATO-Russia Council, which was supposed to be the body in which we talked about these things with Russia. Rather than canceling all meetings, we should have started having 24-hour sessions to talk about it, right. But we didn't. And that is an attitude. One has to be honest about that.
Right. Okay. Well, Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, and author of the new book, The Limits on Partnership, thank you for being here. And John Kornblum, senior counselor for Noor LLC, an international law firm based in Berlin, Germany, thank you as well. And you can continue the conversation and get The On Point podcast is our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, new rules regulating internet traffic may allow companies to pay for faster internet speeds. We'll take a look at net neutrality and the future of the internet. I'm Dina Temple-Raston, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.